Monday, demonstrations in more than 60 cities are planned around the country to protest this crackdown on illegal immigrants. Many of those demonstrators will be waving Mexican flags as a symbol of pride. My next guest says this is a sign that we are headed for another civil war in America. Dr. Jack Wheeler is a former advisor to President Reagan and founder of the Freedom Research Foundation. Why do you say that, Jack?
Well, Neil, we've been predicting on our website, tothepointnews.com, this for a long time. I think it's very, very important that your viewers understand this issue of illegal immigration is really not the basic issue, is not economics and jobs, etc. The issue is sovereignty. The basic issue is that the government of Mexico, the ruling elite of Mexico, is waging war upon the United States with the goal of physically breaking apart the United States and regaining the territory that Mexico ceded to America in the Mexican-American Civil War of 1848.
Do you really think that?
I'm sure of it. I mean, look at all the Mexican flags that are being waved right now. Vicente Fox, the president of Mexico, says, I am the president of 123 million Mexicans. 100 million in Mexico, 23 million Mexicans in the United States. He considers those 23 million Mexicans in the United States, he thinks he is their president, not George Bush.
So many fools in this society think that everybody's at war against them. If it's not the Mexicans, it's Arab Muslims. If it's not Arab Muslims, it's anti-democratic extremists. If it's not these extremists, it's anti-Christians with their war on Christmas. If it's not the anti-Christians, it's the ACLU with their war on the Boy Scouts. If it's not the ACLU, it's the narco-terrorists like Noriega, or strongman Latins like Hugo Chavez. If it's not Chavez, it's Native Americans. If it's not Native Americans, it's rap music, or before that, blues, or jazz, or John Coltrane, who they claim was playing anti-American music, I guess because it expressed a certain form of freedom. And also, it was rock and roll music. That was when people still realized it was created by black people. At the end of the day, it's black folks. It's time us black folks gave them something to really be afraid of. You know what time it is, slave time. You're listening to 103.3. Freakradio.org with Skid in Santa Cruz. 104.1, 107.5, 96.3. LUVER.com, the world. RadioFraud.net, the universe. PropagandaPress.org. Check out Savage Justice in their site. And of course, go to slaverevoltradio.blogspot.com to find out what time it is. Tonight, we're going to shoot our way into the beast apparatus locking horns with one another. So we got all that and a hell of a lot more on 103.3. Slave Revolt.
Everything you know is wrong.
Hello, seekers. Here we go again. And hello, especially to the skeptic inside you who might still believe.
Believe.
split over the tactics on how to construct its overall global empire war strategy. This has created an internal war, debate, and sabotage amongst the ruler's representative class. Tonight we are going to decode this and the reality that these sectors of the ruling order and their entities and apparatus are on. In a Rulings of Empire segment called The Beast Locks Their Horn, decoding the conflict over permanent war strategy between the ruling order factions. As we deal with the neocon sector of a ruling order establishment and the CIA, and how, in the end, their overall goal of world domination and discipline is the same, but the question of how do you get there is what the conflict is firing off about. So let's start off with Brzezinski, former National Security Advisor under the Carter administration, author of the book The Grand Chessboard, legendary geopolitical strategist, mass murderer, orchestrator. He was on a show recently where he was posed the question of a 3-year retrospect of the Iraq occupation. You've heard me go into Brzezinski before, actually many times, and how he aligns himself with the faction of the CIA's tactics. Well, let's go into this step by step as we deal with the beast who are locking horns. So check this out.
When the war began 3 years ago, we turned to two analysts for contact during the first critical week. We do that again tonight with Zbigniew Brzezinski. He was National Security Advisor to President Carter, and he's now a counselor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And Walter Russell Mead, a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Gentlemen, welcome back. We just heard the President say there will be no compromise, there must be victory. Before we get to his definitions, what's your assessment, Mr. Brzezinski, first on where we stand 3 years in?
Well, the fact that it's 3 years speaks for itself. Obviously, we haven't been very successful. We're facing a war of attrition. And in a war of attrition, if the insurgency that's domestic, that's indigenous, is not losing, it is basically winning, because it is fighting against an occupation army. 87% of the Iraqi people want us to leave. That says something. You just heard Mr. Alawi on the air. The fact of the matter is, neither the sectarian conflict between the Shiites and the Sunnis, nor the struggle against us, is abating. It is either continuing at an intense level or getting worse. There are lessons to be drawn from that.
So first off, you can see where Brzezinski does not like the way the situation is going. And from the beginning, just about, he's long denounced the particular strategy. It's not the overall goal of U.S. domination policy that he's against. After all, he's the author of the book The Grand Chessboard. But within his geopolitical strategy and tradition, he believes in various techniques that all have genocidal consequence, but they are more in the forms of techniques called swarming, orange revolutions, where you stir up population furor over democratic change, injecting forms through covert operations and things that have you, of extreme forms of nationalism. So particular countries or regions that may want to cooperate. You get them into a very nationalistic form so that they're broken off from one another. This is one of Brzezinski's historical strategies, especially when it's around the regions of Russia, that he wants the little places next to it, Ukraine, Azerbaijan, you know, all that broken away for key geopolitical reasons. Whereas the sector that the neocons are invested in and represent as part of a ruling order clique. Because when you talk about neocons and all of that, it's just not some abstract lobbyist group that is part of an apparatus, but you're basically talking about elements within the ruling circle, like Cheney, that you go hand in hand with Halliburton, because this is how they've merged. So you have a situation where the strategy that the neocons in the Middle East especially want to partake in is to smash up the Mideast states into ethnic identities forcefully by using the military, not through the techniques that the CIA, Brzezinski, and all of them are adherents to, but by physically crushing them and then breaking them off into three separate, you know, states, like in the case of Iraq, you know, or smashing up and pulverizing Iran. Now, Brzezinski and much of the CIA see this as suicidal and ridiculous, and a strategy that is stirring up a hornet's nest. It's like going into a hornet's nest, shooing away the hornets, swatting at the hornets with the Israeli flag. Now, the reason why the neocons want to do this is because in their alignment with Israel, by smashing up the Persian state of Iran and the various Arab states, they can then push up the position even more so of Israel for its sustainability and its super prestige as a geopolitical bulldog with nuclear arms in the region. Now, either way, whether you're talking about the CIA method, CIA Brzezinski Joseph Wilson slash method of operations, or whether you were talking about the neocons, millions in this global strategy of U.S. imperial domination are slated for death. So it's not about one side being a maniac and another not. We're talking about privatized orders with a privatized agenda for domination of geopolitical resources and control on a planetary scale. The problem is between them is the tactic. So you have a situation where basically Brzezinski and them see the neocons as kind of like a George Armstrong Custer, just riding into the camp of Crazy Horse. Two Moon, Touch the Clouds, Rain in the Face, Gaul, Sitting Bull, with reckless abandon. You know, where Brzezinski would try to create divisions between the camp of Crazy Horse and Sitting Bull and have them fight amongst each other and have them break off into little camps. At the end, still massacre them all, but not just charge right in there with the 7th Cavalry physically, like the neocons are attempting to do. So this is the gist of the intense conflict that you see brewing back and forth. Now next, Brzezinski is asked about the cost benefits of the war in Iraq. So let's check this out.
I think the benefits have in fact been very few beyond the obvious one, the removal of Saddam Hussein. But we have undermined our international legitimacy. That's a very high cost to a superpower. We have destroyed our credibility. No one believes anything the president says anymore. We have tarnished our morality with Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo. These are phenomenal costs. And there's, of course, blood and money and tens of thousands of Iraqis killed. So in my view, the time has come to face all of this, to realize that staying for a prolonged period of time until some ephemeral victory is not the solution. It is time to leave, and I think a four-point program could be implemented that would permit us to leave in a fashion that would not be a debacle. Ask the Iraqi government to ask us to leave, first of all. And some would ask us. Some have already asked us, in fact. Secondly, concert with the Iraqi government on the date of our departure. So it's a joint decision. I was thinking about a year. Third, the Iraqi government then convenes a conference of neighbors, Muslim neighbors, who are interested in continued stability in Iraq and in helping to prevent a civil war from exploding. And fourth, arrange a donors conference for the recovery of Iraq. We could do that. I think we'd be better off if we did it. Otherwise, we're stuck, and this is getting worse and worse. The region is becoming more destabilized and hostile to us. We leave. The Shiites and the Kurds, as Walter said, particularly regarding the Shiites, but the Kurds have to be taken into account, they will dominate the scene. They'll together be 75% of the people. And the Shiites are pretty well armed. The Kurds are extremely well armed and organized. And the Sunnis will then have to face the choice of either accommodating or fighting. My guess is they'll split. Some will choose to accommodate. Some will continue to fight. And this will then be an Iraqi responsibility. We have to get rid of this colonialist mindset that we are there to teach them how to be a country, how to be a democracy, how to avoid a civil war. This is their country. They're quite capable of running it once we're out.
Now, decoding what Brzezinski's saying is a situation where if one is, you know, kind of like one of these like weak liberal types and just takes what he says at face value, or is just that surface depth, that that's what they do, or their understanding of it, some of it, of what he says, can sound quote unquote somewhat rational. But in reality, when Brzezinski talks about his 4-point program, you get many things out of it. One, he said that we should ask the Iraqi government to ask us to leave. So obviously he's talking about manipulation. So it's not really the Iraqi government asking Sam to leave. This is a joint task force tactical move. Set up the date of departure. So it's all orchestrated, you know, with Sam basically in the forefront. Also set up a conference with the Iraqi neighbors. So they're trying, he's thinking of ways to stop this thing from brewing out of control, where the neocon strategy is to basically engulf the whole region into a galactic major fourth world war with bombs flying basically everywhere, where Brzezinski and company are more tacticians and covert style of operators, where they even want Iran to play a role as in part of this conference. Now, of course, neocons, Boy George administration, Boy George in general, all of them are trying to isolate and intensify the conflict with Iran. So the last thing on their mind is the strategy that Brzezinski is saying, because they want the issue more inflamed. They want Iraq to turn more and more into a failed state, because this is their particular tactic and overall strategy that they're on. So you have a situation where Brzezinski outlines a bit about, you know, the Kurds are well armed, and how the Sunnis would be forced to make a choice, and how part of them will break, break away and split up. See, these are the tactics of a noted, disciplined, and experienced imperial grand chessboard strategist. Because this is still a collapsing of the state, of the society. And when I say a collapsing of the state, I don't mean a collapsing of the state into something human. But I'm talking about a collapsing of the society in general, a failed state situation also similar to, you know, Somalia. So when Brzezinski talks about we, meaning Sam, must get out of this colonialist mindset, what he's talking about is a tactical operation of occupying the country outwardly, like the neocons' basic strategy is, as opposed to fomenting trouble, isolation, and so on and so forth. Now, during a crime Bill Clinton's administration, Scott Ritter talked about how when the CIA infiltrated into the people who were investigating, quote-unquote, the weapons of mass destruction, i.e. the inspection team, that Clinton had already set up a program for these guys to assassinate Saddam. So the CIA was in there as part of an assassination operation to find out key locations, where Saddam may likely be. So it was a covert terrorist operation for the murder of Saddam. This is what caused the particular conflict. And as I've gone over, Clinton inherited from Bush the First the policy of no sanctions being removed until Saddam was removed from office. So it went from the Iraqi administration giving up any quote-unquote weapons of mass destruction to regime change, which was not what the whole sanctions were supposed to be about. But when you're an international terrorist, this is how you operate. So they wanted basically someone who would be affable to them and thereby hand over to them resources and anything else the empire wanted. This was their overall strategy. And Crime Bill Clinton, just like Bush First, were willing to starve out over a million people, over 1.5 million people, destroy them in various ways through the sanction, I should say, as a process, which is exactly what happened. Now, Brzezinski didn't have a problem with this. This is in more alignment with what Brzezinski's about, including the aspect of the CIA, a covert mission into the inspection team. So it's a strategic aspect. And if you noticed, you could see why the terrorists on the wing of Brzezinski would like this, because the average liberal, the average progressive, they didn't kick up much dust during this whole process of these incredible sanctions that actually threw more Iraqis in the grave than this current barbaric tactic laid out by the neocon strategy of forced occupation and breaking up the various Mideast states into little ethnic, tribal, religious factions and stuff. Now, to outline how ruthless also this situation is, and how it's not really a situation where these guys are operating from the standpoint of they have some kind of humane streak about how these things are escalating, whether we're talking about Iraq or Iran, and the chaos that could happen from like an attack on Iran. It, once again, it comes down to a tactic. And we all know and have been following how Christopher Hitchens has been defecating all over the place, his vile analysis and twisted, warped vision of how nations should conduct themselves in other people's homeland, as he's justified the invasion, occupation in Iraq at every step of the way. Yet, Hitchens recently wrote another little piece, and this is what he says. Assume that the Iranians are within measurable distance of nuclear status. Appearances sometimes to the contrary, they are not mad, or not clinically insane in the way Saddam Hussein was and Kim Jong-il is. The recent fuss about the obliteration of Israel is largely bullshit. These people who once bought weapons from Israel via Oliver North in order to fight Saddam Hussein are cynical and corrupt. They know as well as you do what would happen if they tried to nuke Israel or the United States. They want the bomb as insurance against invasion and as a weapon of strategic ambiguity to shore up their position in the region. But they have a crucial vulnerability on the inside. The overwhelmingly young population, an ironic result of the mullah's attempt to increase the birth rate after the calamitous war with Iraq, is fed up with the medieval rule. Unlike the hermetic societies of the Ba'athist Iraq and North Korea, Iran has been forced to permit a lot of latitude to its citizens. A huge number of them have relatives in the West, access to satellite dishes and cell phones, and regular contact with neighboring societies. Opinion polls is a new science in Iran, but several believable surveys have shown that a huge majority coverage on one converge on one point, that it is time to resume diplomatic relations with the United States. So picture, if you will the landing of Air Force One at Imam Khomeini International Airport. The president emerges, reclaims the U.S. Embassy in return for an equivalent in Washington and the unfreezing of Iran's financial assets, and announces that sanctions have been a waste of time and have mainly hurt Iranian civilians. He need not add that they have also given some clerics monopoly positions in various black markets. The populace already knows this. A new era is possible. He goes on to say America and the Shiite world have a common enemy in Al-Qaeda, just as they had in Milosevic, the Taliban, and the Iraqi Ba'athists. America is home to a large and talented Iranian community. Let the exchange of trade and people and ideals begin. There might perhaps even be a ticklish to write a paragraph saying that America is not proud of everything it has done in the past, most notably Jimmy Carter's criminal decision to permit Saddam to invade Iran. The aging mullahs might claim this as a capitulation, which would be hard to bear, but how right they would be. The pressure for a new constitution and genuine elections is already building. Within less than a decade, we might be negotiating with a whole new generation of Iranians. Iran would have less incentive to disrupt progress in Iraq. And we should not forget that it has been generally not unhelpful to Afghanistan. Eventually, Iran might have a domestic nuclear program to which it is fully entitled and which would decrease its oil dependency and be ready to sign a non-proliferation agreement with enforceable and verifiable provisions. American technical help would be able for this, since it was we who, in a wonderful movement of Kissinger-Aryan realism, helped them build the Bashir reactor in the first place. Just a thought. So here you have a situation where you have Hitchens talking about doing a technique, a strategy that's more in alignment with Brzezinski. This is not about real cooperation. This is about tactical ways of gaining footholds within society, turning internally public opinion, and if necessary, doing psyops and assassinations and stuff like that, but not sending whole troops or bombs down there, which makes it obvious. Now, we all know that Hitchens with all the other stuff and how he was diatribing out, doesn't have the interest of the Iranian people at heart. This is about global control. But this is just a tactical difference that he has outlined as opposed to what the neocons are outlining. So, in other words, we know that from Hitchens to the neocons, they're all dogs. But it's a tactical issue that is brewing up so much concern and infighting in the House of the Beast. Now here, Brzezinski is asked about the U.S. read this in a narrow way. In other words, the neocon Bush version of spreading democracy. So let's check this out.
But if the administration's goal was democracy, Western-style democracy that would then spread and flower throughout the Middle East, would this kind of withdrawal, whether with Iraq's permission or urging or not, would it end up achieving the goal that we heard the president talk about today?
Well, you know, goals have to be realistic unless they're just slogans. The notion of us occupying Iraq, creating democracy through an occupation, and then that democracy spreading throughout the Middle East, was an illusion from day one.
Not even a worthy goal?
It may be a worthy goal, but a worthy goal that's unrelated to reality is not a serious goal. This is not a serious goal. Someday the region will be democratic, but it will be democratic because democracy has been nurtured from within. It is a potential in most societies. I don't believe that Islamic societies are not capable of being democracies, because we know some Muslim societies that are democracies. But it has to come from within. It is not going to be imposed by an occupation army that's brutalizing the country, while at the same time, quote-unquote, democratizing it.
So once again, you hear Brzezinski talking about how democracy is not going to be gained by an occupation army brutalizing it. Now, this is a person who uses democracy, the term democracy, all the time. But his version of a democratic development is places like Ukraine, these whole Orange Revolution type issues where they use these various swarming techniques. It's not really democracy, it's geopolitical control to basically lock and block Russia in a box, and other countries where their pipelines and resources of oil, natural gas flow, thereby making them interdependent on the U.S., who has formed alliances with these particular issues. And the reason why I point this out is that you have a situation where it looks like there's like a certain type of confusion overall about this strategy issue as opposed to the overall goal. And I emphasize how all of them have the same overall goal of war, world domination of the geopolitical resources throughout the planet, and how that's essential for empires, especially where you have a society like America that's $44 trillion in debt. $44 trillion in public and in private debt. So here you have a situation where they know that they are economically in trouble. The euro keeps rising. And you have a situation also where the petrodollar exchange system, it becomes more and more vulnerable as various power houses or emerging ones, China, for example, are striving to be more energy independent, which is why you see the mad scramble in the Eurasian corridor, the Middle East, Africa, etc. Now, a while back, Bush, you know, all these guys use various terms. You know, you hear the war on terrorism, war on a form of intolerance, war on tyranny, etc., etc. And in part, the reason why they use these types of terms like a war on tyranny is because they want to downplay the issue of a particular state or society that they really can't have a claim that is a quote-unquote terrorist society. Then they'll just say tyranny exists, i.e. a strong man, someone who is not giving quote-unquote democratic rights to its people. Now, in a speech on January 20th, Boy George made this statement. He said, quote, "It is the policy of the United States to seek and support the growth of democratic movements and institutions in every nation and culture, with the ultimate goal of ending tyranny in our world." So here the word tyranny and other types of words that you've been hearing these guys say. Now, when they've named some of the countries that they claim are sponsoring terror or tyranny, Boy George has listed at one time or another 10 different countries in the Middle East and in parts of East Asia. And Condoleezza Rice has also mentioned them. She said Venezuela in South America is high on the list. Burma, North Korea, Iran, Belarus, Zimbabwe. She claimed these as outposts of tyranny. You had Rumsfeld include countries like Syria, Sudan, Yemen, Algeria, Malaysia. They call these emerging targets. So what's interesting, Georgia's also been thrown in there. Now what's interesting about this is when you see these, you know, 10 to 12 nations be emerging targets by the Rumsfelds, the Rices, the Boy George in various speeches that they have made. What you also see throughout this situation is that these various potential targets by this established order serve as a useful description and tactic or overall long-range goal, I should say, of the whole way that the spear of domination for empire in the geopolitical strategy plays itself out. And what I mean by that is that we all know that they've, you know, been going on and on about Chavez. And, you know, Chavez has openly said that he has plans to divert oil sales away from SAM and more go into China. China is making more and more inroads into places like Brazil and at incredibly large numbers of influence and exchange and stuff like that. And what's interesting is that recently, part of the deal that Chavez has made is a new pipeline to a port on the Colombia's coast. And that avoids the U.S. control of the Panama Canal. So as Venezuela and China see what the U.S. geopolitical strategy is, which is basically to dominate the world's energy resources throughout the planet, control key choke points, and militarize certain regions where vast quantities of natural gas or hydrocarbons exist, you have them in various societies maneuver themselves away from this to try to gain or ascertain more and more independence. So Indonesia, Another country that they've thrown on the list has a huge natural gas resource, and that serves mainly China and Japan. So even though Sam is in fairly, you know, even though Sam can be in a situation where he can have on and off again relationships with a particular society from time to time, it doesn't matter because their over geopolitical ambitions is to dominate the particular regions and stuff. And that's just the way it plays off. You know, when the whole thing took place with the tsunami in Indonesia, Paul Wolfowitz, the former U.S. ambassador to Indonesia, went on a fact-finding tour. And the ExxonMobil runs of a huge region in Aceh. In other words, looking for resources and expansion of resources in the region while the issue of the tsunami is going on. You have Manama. That's also now one of the targets. And you have a situation where this is basically a geopolitical strategic encirclement of China taking place with Myanmar, Malaysia, and Aceh in the Indonesian region. So, and also to choke off a vital sea lane on the Strait of Malacca, you know, where all these oil tankers from the Persian Gulf region traveled to China. And also 80% of Japan's oil passes through that particular area. So the, once again, you have the choke point situation where they gain control, Sam, over these regions, choke points, natural resource regions, et cetera, and you basically have a situation where even though the U.S. dollar is crumbling, even though more and more societies are trying to diversify their currency, Sam, if gets in control of the vital resources throughout the planet, has the rest of the planet right where he wants them. So this is the ruthless game that plays out. Now, the U.S. government, its Energy Information Administration, has called the Malacca Strait as one of the most strategic, quote, world oil transit choke points, unquote. So they know what, this is not like coincidence that these particular nations end up on these quote unquote tyranny lists, terrorist lists, so on and so forth. The militarization, the control and domination of regions like Indonesia, Myanmar, Malaysia, would put the U.S. in incredible physical power over one of the most crucial and active sea channels of oil for China and Japan. And it would drastically reduce China's independence maneuvering that's played out on this grand chessboard. Now, this is a similar thing is going on where you take Iran. Now, you've heard me talk about Iran in various points, but Iran also represents a choke point because it's one of the crucial geopolitical choke points in the world throughout the waterways, and that's the Straits of Hormuz. And that's a two-mile-wide passage between the Persian Gulf and the Arabian Sea. So military bases in that region would would increase Sam's geopolitical economic leverage and resource domination in a crucial way. Algeria, another nation that they name, is the second largest a supplier of natural gas to the region of the continental Europe. And it has a very high quality of low sulfur crude oil. 90% of Algeria's oil goes to Europe, mainly Italy, France, and Germany. So once again, you see how crucial this whole aspect is. Now, the issue with Sudan, now, you see this situation where the Christopher Columbuses with turbans on in the Sudan know that they have leverage in the way that they can play their game between China and SAM, because both entities want access to their region. Neither side, either China or SAM, or Russia for that matter, care about the obliteration that the Christopher Columbuses with turbans are doing to the masses of black folks in the Sudan. That's immaterial. As a matter of fact, it's immaterial to most people throughout the planet. You know, I mean, that's the real world. But you have a situation where China has invested around $3 billion since 1999, building various pipelines, you know, oil pipelines from the southern region of the Sudan to the Red Sea port. So the maneuvering that's going back and forth between SAM and China on this geopolitical level, we're not talking about a human level, because we all know that most of humanity do not see black humanity anywhere in the world. Somalia, Yemen, basically, if you look at a map and see the Horn of Africa and then where Yemen is, you see how that little area is also a choke point between the Red Sea and the Indian Ocean. And you have key U.S. firms like Hunt's Oil and all of that playing their particular role in these regions. Now, you, I mentioned a couple of shows ago the issue with Colombia, where Colombia is bordering on one of the largest hydrocarbon reserve areas on the planet, with Venezuela and all of that. And Plan Colombia is not seceding in the Colombian region because of the intense resistance between the guerrilla movement FARC, which controls about half of the country, and because of an upswell of resistance in South America and the awareness of against the U.S. covert and neoliberal type policies and stuff. Now, this has created much consternation, which is why they're now trying to operate covert Guyanese forces as an invasion point into Venezuela, SAM is. But the point of me mentioning this once again is a situation where, see, these are the types of things and issues that Brzezinski thinks need to be concentrated more on. And the tactics, the tactical ways, he believes, are within the traditional covert, you know, assassination type CIA economic hitman type of operations. Now, with the situation in the Middle East, with SAM kicking up so much dust with his cowboy boots in this neocon strategic way, what has happened is that they've pushed up the oil prices because of so much chaos and uncertainty. Now, for big oil, the big oil sector, that's good, I mean, from their perspective. But what it has done is that once those prices went up over $50 per barrel, then that allowed Chavez in Venezuela to now make calls for himself to be crowned king. Because while from a standpoint of cheap oil, Saudi Arabia is still king at having grade A quality cheap oil, Venezuela has the largest supply of heavy oil that's more expensive to process. But if prices are already pushed up there because of this global conflict, then all of a sudden Venezuela becomes the king of oil, which by many reports has a much larger reserve of oil than Saudi Arabia. Now, South America has spun completely out of Sam's control right now. And see, these are the tactical reasons why Brzezinski and the CIA has so much disdain for the neocons and their strategic types of actions. Because these are the things that happen when you overtly do these types of occupations, which is good. See, because, see, this is not about wanting these guys to succeed. It's good that they make strategic mistakes. Empires fall by human beings making strategic mistakes, by human beings becoming careless or overly arrogant, or over a process of time becoming bureaucratized and thinking that they can just mandate out through the world because they're preordained to be on top. So here you have a situation where now Venezuela has now come into play in parts of South America in a much more powerful, vital, and influential play, where they can now have even more of an influence on energy resources, on the dollar system, etc. If Venezuela were now to start diversifying its accounts from the dollar, or did what Saddam did, or start to orchestrate more deals with China with outside of the sphere of the petrodollar system, this would set up even more insecurity within the empire. So when you hear Brzezinski talk about something can be a worthy goal, but that's unrelated to the reality of it being a serious goal or not being a serious goal. In other words, he's talking about tactics, you know. So when you hear him talk about things need to be nurtured within, he's talking about his historical geopolitical grand chessboard orange revolution strategies that have worked so well for him in his various tactical modes as someone who's now part of the National Endowment for quote-unquote democracy and the Center for Strategic and International Studies. So he's a geopolitical imperial tactician. So he's just not out there just rambling and stuff. But this is the clash that you see between him and the various George Armstrong, Custer slash neocon characters, because now the whole thing is spinning more and more out of their control geopolitically, economically, so on and so forth, by the particular tactics that the neocons are trying to implement in the Mideast region. Now, continuing on with this internal quagmire and fight that's going on within the ruling sector, here's Joseph Wilson on the strong, was it George Stephanopoulos program about the leak case that we all know has taken place. So check this out.
Important to draw a distinction here. The declassifying information and providing it to the public when it is in the public interest is one thing. But leaking classified information that could compromise our national security is something that is very serious, and there's a distinction.
That, of course, is White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan at Friday's press conference, where he was barraged by questions about that court filing in the CIA leak case. Libby told prosecutors that he was authorized by President Bush to leak classified information, all to rebut charges made by our next guest, former Ambassador to Iraq, Joseph Wilson. Welcome to This Week.
George, good to be with you.
That court filing also says that government documents, this is a quote, could be characterized as reflecting a plan to discredit, punish, or seek revenge against Mr. Wilson. Do you now believe that President Bush was part of that plan?
I have no idea, but I think the court documents reflect accurately the situation. After all, 4 months before the State of the Union address, both the Senate and the White House were advised that there was nothing to this charge that was later in the State of the Union address. Indeed, in January, it was reported today that the National Intelligence Officer, speaking on behalf of the intelligence community, sent a memo to the U.S., the rest of the U.S. government, including the White House, saying that this charge is baseless and should be dropped. On July 7th, the day after my article appeared in the New York Times, the White House said to the press, the 16 words did not rise to the level of inclusion in the State of the Union address. That was the day before Mr. Libby embarked upon this campaign to further the disinformation that was launched in the President's State of the Union address and to smear me, which ultimately led to the compromise of the identity of my wife.
The White House, as you know, Scott McClellan said it there in the press conference, said this was necessary for the national interest. He said it was in the national interest, and he went on to say more, and I want to show you a little bit more of that press conference.
There are people that were out there making irresponsible accusations that intelligence was manipulated or that intelligence was misused. There's been no evidence to back that up whatsoever.
He's talking about you.
Well, of course they're talking about me, but in actual fact, several months before the State of the Union address, the White House and the Senate were advised, don't use this information, it is baseless. If you then use the information, you are twisting intelligence to support political decisions that have already been made. And in July, when you selectively leak pieces of the national intelligence estimate, and when you attribute pieces in the body to key judgments, you are furthering that disinformation campaign. That's what Mr. Libby did. Indeed, it seems to me it is long past time for the White House to come clean on all of this. There are two things that I think ought to be done. One, I believe that the President and the Vice President need to release the transcripts of their testimony to the prosecutor so that we all know precisely what it was that was said to the prosecutor in response to questions in this matter. And two, when Mr. Fitzgerald's filing, he made it very clear that multiple sources in the White House were engaged in the smear campaign. The President said that he would fire anybody who was leaking. I think that we ought to know who those multiple sources were, and the President ought to fire them if he hopes to keep maintain any sort of trust with the American people.
We are learning a little bit more each day. Last night, a lawyer close to the case was quoted in the Associated Press saying that the President didn't directly tell Scooter Libby to go to the New York Times or any kind of specific information like that. He simply told Vice President Cheney, get the information out, declassify this information. Vice President Cheney took care of the rest. Do you accept that?
Well, look, I'm not going to sit here and accuse the President of the United States of any betraying the national security of the country. But at the end of the day, if you're going to say, get the information out, that basically means declassify the national intelligence estimate, not selective pieces of this that support decisions that you've made, even though they are not grounded in fact. And that's what Mr. Libby did.
There is no suggestion in this court filing that either the Vice President or the President actually directed that your wife, Valerie Plame, the former CIA agent, that her identity be revealed. Do you accept that this was something that the President and the Vice President were not involved in?
Look, I have no way of knowing. The last person in the world that either the President or the Vice President speak to these days is Joe Wilson. I would like them to speak to the American people. There are transcripts of their testimony to the special prosecutor. It seems to me that we could easily clear this up by releasing those White House transcripts.
In the past, your own credibility has been called into question. I want to show you a Washington Post article that was written about the Senate Intelligence Committee report. It said that the panel found that Wilson's report, rather than debunking intelligence about purported uranium sales to Iraq, as he has said, bolstered the case for most intelligence analysts, and contrary to Wilson's assertions and even the government's previous statements, the CIA did not tell the White House it had qualms about the reliability of the African intelligence that made its way into the 16 fateful words in President Bush's January 2003 State of the Union address. What's your response to the Senate committee?
Well, I think if you go back and you read that report, it makes very clear that on October 2nd of 2002, the Senate itself was informed by the Deputy Director of Central Intelligence that the judgment of the U.S. intelligence community was that the British had stretched the case on the matter of uranium sales from Africa to Iraq. Within four days, the Director of Central Intelligence had informed the White House on three different occasions, once by phone and two by emails, that, to quote Mr. Tenet, I do not want the President of the United States to be a witness of fact in this matter because the evidence is weak, because one of the mines in question is flooded, and because we believe the British have exaggerated the matter. That was 4 weeks before, 4 months before the State of the Union address. We now know from reporting in the news division of the Washington Post that in January, the National Intelligence Officer called the allegation baseless. Now, I don't know what more the intelligence community at the senior management level has to say to the political leadership of this country to tell them not to use this particular allegation.
Now, the issue with Joseph Wilson brings up many problems that I see going on with certain sectors within the quote-unquote progressive movement and so on and so forth. And especially those who are really just into this aspect of the neocons being the end-all to be-all of evil. So when, as opposed to just being part of an apparatus that's a privatized ruling order for decimation and domination on a planetary scale. As I mentioned before, all of those areas that were listed as outposts of tyranny or terrorists, surprise, surprise, you can also find them being in key locations of choke points or having large hydrocarbon or natural gas reserves, from Algeria to Venezuela to Iran, so on and so forth. So between them is not so much, between the various ruling class sectors, is not an issue of controlling the resources. They all believe on in that. It's how you tactically get there. Now, that brings up, what is Joseph Wilson? And in many people's rush, the claim that Joseph Wilson was somehow some kind of harbinger of truth because of what he did, you know, writing the thing, exposing Boy George and them in the Niger issue, you know, uranium Iraq issue. Wilson is someone that has deeply been involved in issues in Africa. And you have a situation where he was the senior director for African Affairs and part of the National Security Council. He was involved in the Angolan situation, and he helped orchestrate the basically push out of the Cuban forces that were in Angola, helping the Angolan people get their liberation from the South African forces, the U.S. forces that and CIA that were backing Savimbi, along with China, who were all in this despotic move to dominate Angola. After Wilson helped orchestrate the removal of the Cubans, he then was part of facilitating turmoil amongst the three major groups in Angola. This is kind of the Brzezinski type strategy, you know, saying it for, you know, national independence, but pushing nationalistic fear and ethnic type of divisions. Who did they align with, or someone that they had already made some inroads with? Savimbi, you know, through the whole John Stockwell In Search of Enemies construct with the CIA. So what you basically had was a situation where millions died as a result. Joseph Wilson was part of that. He goes to Gabon. He, in 92, as an ambassador, sets up these fake, open, quote-unquote, operations. Decimates Gabon. Niger. He goes there in 99. A military coup happens. And then one of the guys involved in the coup basically aligns themselves up with Sam. Basically, what you had through Joseph Wilson is a situation where former colonialists, British, French, etc., were being pushed out by U.S. orchestrated covert operation, and Joseph Wilson was a key orchestrator. Now, one of the things that is quite revealing, I should say, is that, you know, I see many of these liberal types, progressive types, when Perkins released his book, anywhere Perkins was at, they would go run, John Perkins, that is, and check him out, you know, Confessions of an Economic Hitman. Yet Wilson comes out with this Niger story, and he gets embraced by all these elements, you know, write-ups favorable about him from Counterpunch on down the line. Yet, well, what the hell is Joseph Wilson? I mean, it's obvious he works within that whole economic hitman, covert CIA operation sphere. He was, when April Glaspie left Iraq, he was left in charge. And he is the one who helped set up basically the hit piece on Saddam after they suckered him, through the whole slant drilling through Kuwait, him going in thinking that he would go take part of Kuwait, give U.S. good prices, cheap prices on oil. Wilson and them played along and then basically said, look, we got our gunboats out there and you got your troops over in Kuwait. Stick them up. That's basically how the thing kind of played out. So what I'm basically saying is that when you have a situation where the names were released by Boy George in them, of Valerie Plame was a CIA operative. She's an enemy. That's good that they're internally fighting. It's good when they get their asses shot off because of disputes that sectors of the ruling class are having amongst each other. Joseph Wilson is also an enemy. He's part of the enemy apparatus. He has so much blood on his hands that it'll never be washed clean. And to see this fool go on one radio show after another, I'm talking about quote-unquote progressive ones, and basically be treated like a prince, do speeches, you know, at all these different forums, like he's the apostle of good, tells you how decrepit and void things are. And part of it is because since you really can't get people to explore what's really happening on the African continent, all anyone has to say is Joseph Wilson was an ambassador to, you know, different parts of Africa, and that's just taken as, you know, some kind of benign thing. When basically he was a covert operative economic hitman for the imperialist order in a ruthless and barbaric way. Now, what's also interesting is you have in a Seymour Hersh's article that he wrote called Stovepipe. This was October 27th. 2003. Hersh wrote this: Joseph Wilson, the diplomat who had traveled to Africa to investigate the allegations more than a year earlier, revived the Niger story. He was angered by what he saw at the White House's dishonesty about Niger, and in early May, he casually mentioned his mission to Niger and his findings during a brief talk about Iraq at a political conference in suburban Washington, sponsored by the Senate Democrat Policy Committee. Wilson is a Democrat. Another speaker at the conference was the Times columnist Nicholas Kristof, who got Wilson's permission to mention the Niger trip in a column. A few months later, on July 6th, Wilson wrote about the trip himself on the Times op-ed page. Quote, I gave them months to correct the record, unquote. He told me, speaking of the White House, but, quote, but they kept on lying. The White House responded by blaming the intelligence community for the Niger reference in the State of the Union address. Condoleezza Rice, the National Security Advisor, told a television interviewer on July 13th, quote, had there been even a peep that the agency did not want that sentence in, or that George Tenet did not want that sentence, it would have been gone, unquote. 5 days later, a senior White House official went a step further, telling reporters at a background briefing that they had the wrong impression about Joseph Wilson's trip to Niger and the information it had yielded. Quote, you can't draw a conclusion that we were warned by Ambassador Wilson that this was all dubious, unquote. The unnamed official said, according to White House transcript, quote, it's just not accurate. But Wilson's account of his trip forced the rattled White House to acknowledge for the first time that, quote, this information should not have risen to the level of presidential speech, unquote. It also triggered retaliatory leaks to the press by White House officials that exposed Wilson's wife as a CIA operative and led to an FBI investigation. Now, why I mentioned that was that, once again, as I've been outlining the conflict that you see going on, Hersh reveals an aspect of this in the same article, Stovepipe, where he goes on to say, quote, who produced the fake Niger papers? There is nothing approaching a consensus on this question within the intelligence community. There has been published speculations about the intelligence service of several different countries. One theory favored by some journalists is Rome, is that the SISMI produced the false documents and passed them to a Panorama for publication. Another explanation was provided by a former senior CIA officer. He had begun talking to me about the Niger papers in March, when I first wrote about the forgery and said, quote, somebody deliberately let something false get in there, unquote. He became more forthcoming in subsequent months, eventually saying that a small group of disgruntled retired CIA clandestine operators had banded together in the late summer of last year and drafted the fraudulent documents themselves. Quote, the agency guys were so pissed at Cheney, unquote, the former officer said. Quote, they said, okay, we're going to put the bite on these guys, unquote. My source said that he was first told of the fabrication late last year at one of the many holiday gatherings in the Washington area of past and present CIA officials. Quote, everyone was bragging about it. Here's what we did. It was cool, cool, cool. These retirees, he said, had superb contacts among current officers in the agency and were informed in detail of the SISMI intelligence. Quote, they thought that with this crowd, it was the only way to go, to nail these guys who were not practicing good trade craft and vetting intelligence, unquote. My source said, quote, they thought it would be brought at lower levels, a big bluff, unquote. The thinking, he said, was that the documents would be endorsed by Iraq hawks at the top of the Bush administration, who would be unable to resist flaunting them at a press conference or an interagency government meeting. They would then look foolish when intelligence officials pointed out that they were obvious fakes. But the tactic backfired, he said, when the papers won widespread acceptance amongst the administration. Quote, it got out of control, unquote. So once again, from what Hirsch was saying, it looked like a situation where the conflict between tactics, the Rumsfeld tactic of disintegrating and usurping power from the CIA and streamlining it with his office of special plans and all of these other things, because they weren't getting the quote unquote right information that they wanted, created a backlash that played itself out in a way where another sector of representatives of the rulers, the CIA branch with Brzezinski and so on and so forth, struck back to undermine. And this is the type of interplay you see. And what's interesting is that the person who sent Joseph Wilson to Iraq, Niger, was Valerie Plame, his wife's boss. And when Joseph Wilson got back, he didn't go back to the administration and give them, or the neocons or any of those guys, to give them any kind of a breakdown of his findings. He was first debriefed by the CIA, once again locking him in to that element, which is where he's about and what he's about. So this outlines the type of geopolitical strategist alignment and tradition that Wilson comes from, and that the conflict that emerged, the CIA sets up the neocon branch. The neocon branch is infuriated when Wilson writes an op-ed. They do their payback. These are the beasts within the cauldrons of the Pentagon and within the ruling circles, fighting it out amongst each other. Now here, Stephanopoulos asked about Fitzgerald's, you know, the lead prosecutor of Libya and them, findings of the leak on Valerie Plame. Dig this.
Quoted the Fitzgerald findings, saying that multiple White House people in the White House were involved in revealing your wife's identity or talking about your wife's identity. It says that there was a plan to discredit, punish, or seek revenge against Mr. Wilson. Are you going to file a civil suit against the White House or against individuals in the White House?
Well, we're holding all our options open. At the end of the day, it seems to me that first and foremost, the White House needs to come clean on this matter. My own view of this is that the White House owes the American people, and particularly our service people who have been sent into war, an apology for having misrepresented the facts.
But you are prepared to file a suit?
Oh, we're keeping all options open in this matter.
Ambassador Wilson, thank you very much.
Good to be with you.
So, of course, when they're talking about keeping, Wilson and all of these guys, they're, you know, on front of the cameras, they're playing it out cool because they're trying to get consensus swayed, you know, in their particular way. So it's a strategic game that they're trying to present. But internally, they're working with each other in the most ruthless way. And Fitzgerald, once again, highlights this. Fitzgerald is not, once again, as he's now portrayed as some kind of, you know, bastion of justice, you know, embraced by liberal and progressive circles. Fitzgerald also has a background that exposes his alignment also. And you have Fitzgerald. He was involved in the conviction of the blind Egyptian cleric, you know, the whole World Trade Center bombing, that whole frame up, you know, where they sent some guy in there, undercover, you know, the FBI and the Mossad tape recording messages or conversations while he's trying to get people to carry out particular acts. You know, in other words, they had an asset, the FBI did. Now, Fitzgerald then worked with Chertoff, you know, now the Homeland Security thug, on this whole Mossad FBI setup of the Egyptian, the blind Egyptian clerk, and others. It was Fitzgerald who framed up Lynn Stewart, the lawyer for the blind cleric. So Fitzgerald even recorded the conversations between Lynn Stewart and the blind cleric. And he was involved in the prosecution in the bombing in Africa, you know, Tanzania and Kenya in 1998. He took on the leak case when the Department Attorney General Comey asked him to in December of 2003. This is how these whole things really played out. Fitzgerald is part, you know, in parcel to this kind of disciplining apparatus that is part of the state apparatus, where he's more aligned with elements like Joseph Wilson and Brzezinski and all of that. It's a clash between various ruling sectors of this particular society. Now, once again, I emphasize that all of these sectors represent privatization, globalization, decimation of the human species on the planet, incredible depopulation through their various forms of wars and lack of access to water, etc., etc., because they're privatizers. But it's a tactical battle, how one tactically goes about this, and is the tactic that's taking place in the Middle East also undermining tactics and emphasis that many of the imperialists believe the U.S. should be more concentrated on a global scale. Now, within that context, once again, let's listen to Brzezinski in another setting outlining his opinions on the future of Ukraine. So check this out.
It gives me great pleasure to recognize Dr. Zbigniew Brzezinski, whose name cropped up in letters from Russia that were received by millions of Ukrainians, in which he was denounced as the author of all of the Russian Federation's troubles in Ukraine. Please, Vic.
Maybe after that I better sit down. I have a comment masquerading as a question.
Clearly, we are at the historic moment, and what we're witnessing is profoundly moving. In terms of Ukraine,
the birth of nation.
It is the wedding of Ukrainian nationalism with Ukrainian democracy on a popular level. And that is a dramatic moment in the history of a nation of almost 50 million people. So we have to be profoundly conscious of it, and this meeting, I think, is symbolic of that. And in that setting, I think it's also appropriate for us as private citizens to express our support and a commitment of support to President-elect Yushchenko, because I think it's very important to be clear about that. I think the scale of the fraud and the statistical result officially announced clearly indicates that he was the victor. And that brings me to the question or the comment. Ambassador Fried spoke about the importance of clarity, and I think you're quite right. Clarity is essential. And I think we have, both in the United States and in Europe, clarified our position, our view of what is happening. But I think clarity will increasingly call for more than that, namely clarity also about consequences. Clarity about consequences. And these consequences have to be both positive and negative. And they have to be both positive and negative vis-a-vis Ukraine, but also vis-a-vis Russia. Because we cannot separate the issue from Russia. Because ultimately the issue of Ukraine involves the future of Russia. The Ukrainian struggle for democracy is a struggle about the future of Russia. If Ukrainian democracy prevails, Russia has no choice but to go to the West and to be a democracy. If Ukrainian democracy fails, Russian imperial ambitions are reawakened. There is the temptation of an alternative future which is imperial and authoritarian. So we are involved because of the scale of this problem. And therefore the consequences have to be both positive and negative. Positive in terms of inducements. Inducements to Ukraine. To Ukraine in the sense of awards for Ukraine going forth with democracy. Inducements for Kuchma and his family. Assurances about their personal safety. About their quote-unquote fortune, arrangements which provide encouragement for decent resolution. And Kuchma has to be made aware of the fact that the Lukashenko choice is not going to be profitable for him. And that has to be made clear to Moscow too, because Moscow sponsored Lukashenko. Kuchma has to be aware of the fact that the best outcome for him is the Saakashvili result. And there looms in the background the danger of a Ceausescu consequence if he doesn't accommodate. And in terms of negative consequences, if things go badly in Ukraine, if we end up with a Lukashenko arrangement, at least for a while, we shouldn't just ostracize Ukraine. If we just punish Ukraine, we'll push it more into the hands of those in the Kremlin who would like to recreate a larger Russian sphere. And therefore, it has to have an effect on American-Russian relations. And that has to be stated flatly and boldly, privately at this stage, not by you and the government. But it's something that the Russians have to be made aware of, that simply succeeding with the Lukashenko model in Ukraine is not going to be a free ride for Russia. Because otherwise, the Russians have no incentive also to tell Kuchma, lay off, we don't want a crisis to the south, we don't want an explosion in Ukraine, and we don't want ostracism, tensions, worsened relations with the West. So we and the Europeans have to be very clear on this, because the stakes are truly of historic proportions.
All right, what all this coded word and tactical stuff is really meaning when he's talking about the wedding of Ukraine nationalism with Ukrainian democracy and populism, and how you can't separate the issue of Ukraine with Russia. Basically, he's following a tactic of, I don't want to get too technical, but it's Prometheism. It's Prometheism. And that's basically a political project to break up the Soviet Union by separating and supporting nationalist independent movements. And it was first started against Tsarist Russia, And it was created by a Polish dude named Joseph Kaczynski. And Brzezinski's grand chessboard strategy is in part based in that kind of imperial strategic conquest. Because if you look at a map and you look at Ukraine and all these different little states surrounding, incredible amounts of natural gas and oil flow through these particular regions. So Brzezinski was involved himself in the Ukrainian operation. The NED, N-E-D, was founded by the Reagan administration. And basically that was a privatization operation where the CIA would perform a lot of functions. And they used these techniques like called swarming, where they would help orchestrate these mass astroturf demonstrations, like in Belgrade and, you know, against Milosevic. And the image that people saw, but it got undermined, where you saw all these people, at least in the very narrow picture, celebrating the toppling of Saddam's statue and all of that type of stuff. Now, with the Ukraine, once again, this is part of, like I said, the grand chessboard strategic thing. And they'll talk about democracy or these states or have tyrants or whatever, but at the end of the day, the Ukraine, the oil pipeline from European oil imports from Russia carries 75% of it. So it goes from through Ukraine from Russia, 75% through this region. Here you also have 34% of European natural gas goes through the Ukraine. So here you have Russia and the major oil pipes and natural gas pipes run through the Ukraine. This is why when I talk about all of these particular areas where Sam is trying to geopolitically cap off and have a near sphere of influence, it's for these geopolitical things because you can then control a particular country's economic well-being and destiny, at least within, you know, a particular time frame, by these geopolitical maneuvers and stuff. So this is why you see these strategies taking place by Brzezinski and company in Turkmenistan, Azerbaijan, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, on and on. And when you look at a map and see maps that especially have the oil pipelines and natural gas pipelines, you see how they're trying, just in the way that I mentioned about how they're trying to encircle China with the whole Indonesia, Malaysia, you know, have them in their sphere of influence, and then try to capture control of important waterways, straits, i.e. choke points. These are for the same type of techniques. This is what's taking place. Now, all of them within the ruling circle, whether you're a neocon or whether you are a Brzezinski, CIA, Joseph Wilson, grand chessboard strategist, they all agree about the control, the U.S. domination of these types of regions and institutions. It's tactically how do you go about this particular method. And that is where the conflict is seriously brewing up, because the tactic that the George Armstrong Custards, neocons, are deploying, even though they seem fairly satisfied with it, it's a tactic that many within the ruling circle, especially the Brzezinski types, see as one that is going to have incredible detrimental ramifications for the wrong people, i.e. the rulers in America. Now, let's check out Seymour Hersh. Step back for a second and into what Hersh had to say to Chris Matthews on MSNBC's Hardball about the Iranian situation. Check this out.
So said a couple of times in the last few weeks that even Iran getting the knowledge of how to make a weapon is a line they can't cross. And so meanwhile, Iran is not backing down. Cyrus the Great, the Persians. And so as somebody, I quote somebody as saying, Bush has set a hard line. The Iranians aren't backing down. Something bad is going to happen, Cy.
You know, in the last war that was started by this administration for right or wrong reasons, the argument was made, which was telling with most people, was they have a nuclear weapon they're developing and they're going to develop a vehicle for delivering it here to the United States. But at least in that case, they said they were actually going to hit us. Does anyone in this administration believe that Iran would ever drop a nuclear weapon on the United States?
Iran isn't even close. One of the reasons that some
Why would they want to do something as suicidal as that?
Well, that's the point. And if you want to make the analogy that Saddam Hussein and the leadership of Iran are one and the same, that's a big mistake. The Iranians are much more pragmatic. They're Persian. The country's been around a long time. The leadership, they're mullahs, they're religious mullahs. We don't like this mouthy kid who's the president, Ahmadinejad. He's a big mouth. But the Ayatollah who runs the country, Khamenei, is considered to be not only more powerful, but much more pragmatic. Are they going to commit suicide? No. Are they close to a bomb? Here's the other issue, Chris. Even the Israelis will say that Iran is anywhere from 1 to 2 or slightly more years away from making a bomb. Our own estimate, the American estimate, is 8 to 10 years. What's the rush is what I'm hearing. And I'll give an answer. And one of the answers I'm getting not only from the military, but from the people in Vienna at the International Atomic Energy Agency, the monitoring agency, IAEA, but also from our allies, British, French, and German, our allies in this whole game to convince the Iranians to back down. Our allies all say the same thing. They believe that this president is not really that interested in stopping the weapons, the small little amount of weapons that they're going to do, the enrichment that's going to happen in a couple of weeks. But the real American game is regime change. They want to get rid of the mullahs. And they think by bombing they can, I quote somebody as saying, they think by bombing they can humiliate the religious leadership and to the point where the people will rise up and overthrow them.
Same thing as last time.
Da.
Thank you. Seymour Hersh of the New Yorker magazine, another breakthrough article by Seymour.
Now, Hersh knows a little bit more than just the whole regime change claim. He knows that the neocon strategy is really to bomb them into smithereens and break up the country into little bitty pieces and stuff like that to forever crush a possible threat emerging from Iran. So the neocon's overall strategy is beyond just a regime change. Because just a regime change, just like a one-time, you could have Shah, you know, some thug favorable to U.S. Policies and interests. Another regime can come in and be into a particular conflict with that, which is something that with their overall strategy, they don't want. So this is part of the reason why they just want to break up and crush up these particular states in the Mideast region basically indefinitely. What's also interesting is that you also have, you know, Hersh, to show you how dangerous things are, it's like every time these things seem like they're becoming more and more focused about an oncoming type of attack that the CIA is in conflict with, especially, Hersh comes out with another article outlining what the Bush administration is up to next. Now, I'm not saying Hersh is an agent of the CIA, because I don't believe that's what he is, but I believe that he obviously has a close relationship with the intelligence apparatus, and they trust him, he trusts them, and they use each other for these releases. And in this type of current conflict, you could really see it playing itself out. Now, even a while back, Hirsch wrote an article called The Coming War: What the Pentagon Can Now Do in Secret. This was January 24th, 2005. And part of it, Hirsch outlines like this. Under Rumsfeld's new approach, I was told U.S. military operatives would be permitted to pose abroad as corrupt foreign businessmen seeking to buy contraband items that could be used in nuclear weapon systems. In some cases, according to the Pentagon advisors, local citizens could be recruited and asked to join up with guerrillas or terrorists. This could potentially involve organizing, carrying out combat operations, or even terrorist activities. Some operations will likely take place in nations in which there is an American diplomatic mission with an ambassador and a CIA station chief, the Pentagon consultant said. The ambassador and the station chief would not necessarily have to need to know under the Pentagon's current interpretation of its reporting requirements. The new rules would enable the special forces community to set up what it calls action teams, quote-unquote, in the target countries overseas, which can be used to find and eliminate terrorist organizations. Quote, do you remember the right-wing execution squads in El Salvador, unquote, the former high-level intelligence official asked me, referring to the military-led gang that committed atrocities in the early 1980s. We founded them and we financed them, he said. The objective now is to recruit locals in any area we want, and we aren't going to tell Congress about it, unquote. A former military officer who has knowledge of the Pentagon commando capabilities said, quote, we're going to be riding with the bad boys, unquote. One of the rationales for such tactics was spelled out in a series of articles by John Aquila, a professor of defense analysis at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California, and a consultant on terrorism for the RAND Corporation. Quote, it takes a network to fight a network, unquote. Aquila wrote in a recent article in the San Francisco Chronicle that, quote, when conventional military operations and bombing failed to defeat the Mau Mau insurgencies in Kenya in the 1950s, the British formed teams of friendly Kikishu tribesmen who went about pretending to be terrorists. These pseudo-gangs, as they were called, swiftly threw the Mau Mau on the defensive, either by befriending and then ambushing bands of fighters or by guiding bombers to the terrorist camps. What worked in Kenya a half century ago has a wonderful chance of undermining trust and recruitment among today's terror networks, forming new pseudo-gangs, which should not be difficult. Unquote. So it goes, quote, if a confused young man from Marin County can join up with Al-Qaeda, unquote, Aquila wrote, referring to John Walker Lynn, the 20-year-old Californian who was seized in Afghanistan, quote, think what professional operatives might do, unquote. So this shows you how serious that these guys are, where they're going to have setting up secret clandestine operations, which is no surprise, involved in terrorist operations, but they're openly talking about it, openly saying this is part of their program as a so-called counter-terrorism measure. But it's gotten to the point where even conservative writer Paul Craig Roberts has come out with an article in March 16th of 2006 saying, quote, it's another 9/11 in the works. This is a conservative saying this. This is what he says, quote, if you were President George W. Bush with all available U.S. troops tied down by the Iraqi resistance and you were unable to control Iraq or political diplomats in the country, would you start a war with Iran? Yes, you would. Bush's determination to spread Middle East conflict by striking Iran does not make sense. First of all, Bush lacks the troops to do the job. If the U.S. military cannot successfully occupy Iraq, there is no way that the U.S. can occupy Iran, a country approximately three times the size in area and population. Second, Iran can respond to a conventional air attack with missiles targeted at American ships and bases and on oil facilities located throughout the Middle East. Third, Iran has the human assets, including the Shia majority population in Iraq, that it can activate to cause chaos throughout the Mideast. Fourth, polls of U.S. troops in Iraq indicate that a vast majority do not believe in their mission and wish to be withdrawn, unlike the yellow ribbon folks at home. The troops are unlikely to be enthusiastic about being trapped in an Iranian quagmire in addition to the Iraqi quagmire. Fifth, Bush's polls are down to 34%, with a majority of Americans believing that Bush's invasion of Iraq was a mistake. If you were being whipped in one fight, would you start a second fight with a bigger, stronger person? That's what Bush is doing. Opinion polls indicate that the Bush regime has succeeded in its plan to make Americans fear Iran as the greatest threat against America faces. The Bush regime has created a major dispute with Iran over the country's nuclear energy program, then blocked every effort to bring the dispute to a peaceful end. In order to gain a pretext for attacking Iran, the Bush regime is using bribery and coercion in an effort to have Iran referred to the UN Security Council for sanctions. In recent statements, President Bush and Pentagon Chief Don Rumsfeld blamed Iran for the Iraqi resistance, claiming that the roadside bombs used by the resistance are being supplied by Iran. It is obvious that Bush intends to attack Iran and that he will use every means to bring war about. Yet, Bush has no conventional means of waging war with Iran. His bloodthirsty neoconservatives have prepared plans for nuking Iran. However, an unprovoked nuclear attack on Iran would leave the U.S. already regarded as a pariah nation totally isolated. Readers whose thinking runs ahead of that of most of us tell me that another 9/11 event will prepare the ground for a nuclear attack on Iran. Some readers say that Bush or Israel, as in Israel's highly provocative attacks on the Jericho jail and kidnapping of prisoners with American complicity, will provoke a second attack on the U.S. Others say that Bush or the neoconservatives, working with some black ops, quote-unquote, group, will orchestrate the attack. One of the more extraordinary suggestions is that a low-yield, perhaps tactical nuclear weapon will be exploded some distance out from the U.S. port. Death and destruction will be minimized, but fear and hysteria will be maximized. Americans will be told that the ship bearing the weapons was discovered and intercepted just in time, thanks to Bush's illegal spying program, and that Iran is to blame. A more powerful wave of fear and outrage will again bind the American people to Bush, and the U.S. media will not report the rest of the U.S. media will not report the rest of the world's doubts of this explanation. Reads like Michael Cheriton plot, doesn't it? Fantasy? Let's hope so. So once again, this is a conservative author writing this, and it's gotten to the point where they talk about black ops, but as I read before in the Seymour Hersh's article that was released in 2005, January 24th, the coming war, where they openly talked about already having these action teams set up, similar to the death squads in El Salvador. So the various sectors within the society know how committed this particular element of the rulers are into getting the particular type of tactical war that they want. And this is why you see so much consternation amongst Brzezinski, the CIA, and other elements. But one of the things that should be brought up is that, is this tactic working? Will it work? And what is working in resistance? No one can really say at this point in time that the opposition groups to American imperialism are really putting a hamper on Sam's imperial goals and tactics. But one could say that what's going on in South America and the various tactics and movements combined in various settings are hampering Sam's global strategic conquest. And it looks like there should be some consideration towards supporting some of these types of tactics and movements that are taking place on a global scale that are hampering Sam's global strategic overreach and overbite on a planetary scale. This is why I've been saying that some of the campaigns that we should have outside of some of the other stuff should be like a worldwide campaign against the U.S. dollar, because of how the U.S. dollar is so vulnerable and is one of the Achilles heels of the empire. And supporting various guerrilla movements, not uncritically, but the movements that are not, or any type of thing that are resisting or stopping Sam from getting control of geopolitical choke points or reserves that he is so desperately and viciously going after, as we see it taking place everywhere in the world on his geopolitical grand chessboard game, while at the same time they continue to flip the script about bringing justice and truth to the planet.
People need time to adjust and adapt to new ideas. For the past minutes, I've been commenting on the challenges facing our country, not just our government, but our country, in fighting a war in this new media age. And while the enemy is increasingly skillful at manipulating the media and using the tools of communication to their advantage, it should be noted that we have an advantage as well. And that is quite simply that the truth is on our side. And ultimately, in my view, truth wins out. I believe with every bone in my body that free people, exposed to sufficient information, will, over time, find their way to right decisions. Throughout the world, advances in technology are forcing a massive information flow that dictators and extremists ultimately will not be able to control. Blogs are rapidly appearing even in countries where the press is still government controlled. Pro-democracy forces are communicating and organizing by email, pages, and BlackBerry. Today in Iraq, an energetic media has emerged from the rubble of Saddam Hussein's police state with nearly 300 newspapers, over 90 radio stations, and more than 40 television stations.
Everything this dog Rumsfeld is saying is the exact same thing that they're trying to suppress here, undermine here, and of course, do the Armstrong-Williams propagandize over there. The truth is not on their side. But truth alone is not the answer for us. It's a particular forms of actions, techniques, and strategies that we must take on this grand chessboard, and not lock oneself into a particular type of form of resistance. When any form has when any kind of form has certain types of possibilities at a given time, these things should be looked into and analyzed as possible, supportable tactics against the beast. Because while they're locking horns, we should slay these dogs into the ground and into their graves permanently. Until the next time. Slave out.